Welcome to the Deep Dive, and thank you for joining us for the Federal News Update for Tuesday, August 26th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson, your guide through the latest actions of the U.S. federal government.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, here to help connect the dots and explore the broader implications of these developments. We've certainly got a lot to unpack from what was a very busy and, I think, pivotal few days.
Absolutely. Our mission today is really to give you, our listener, a thorough and insightful report on every significant action from the U.S. federal government since the beginning of August 23rd, 2025, right up to today, August 26th. Mm-hmm. We'll be looking across, you know, the executive, legislative, and judicial branches.
That's right. And this isn't just going to be a basic summary. We're planning to go into, well, granular detail on the impact and implications of each significant move.
Yeah.
Think of it as your shortcut to being truly, deeply well-informed on the state of federal governance right now. What we've seen in just these 4 days reveals quite a lot about current policy trajectories and, maybe more importantly, how different branches are interacting.
Or not interacting in some cases.
Oh, yes, conspicuously not interacting at all. That's a key part of the story here.
Okay, let's unpack this. The period from August 23rd to August 26th, 2025, it was really defined by a surge of decisive executive action, really setting the stage for significant shifts in both domestic and foreign policy.
Yeah.
And this happened against a backdrop of, well, complete legislative silence. The executive branch truly took the reins here, didn't it? Demonstrating a clear preference for unilateral directives and largely bypassing Congress.
The striking aspect here, I think, is how clearly these actions reveal an aggressive use of presidential authority. I mean, really pushing a specific policy agenda.
Mm-hmm.
It's challenging established legal and political norms. And frankly, it sets the stage for considerable conflict down the road.
Sure.
We'll see how this administration is actively leveraging its full executive powers,
right,
often creating immediate friction, legal challenges right in its wake.
Right.
The speed and the method of these policy implementations, it really highlights a strategic choice, doesn't it? To act decisively from the top.
It does. A very deliberate strategy. So the vast majority of federal government activity during this period, it was concentrated on just one day, August 25th, 2025.
That's right.
The president signed a series of high-impact executive orders and proclamations that truly showcase the administration's top priorities and, I'd say, its preferred method of governance.
Yes.
Swift, unilateral directives from the White House aiming to quickly implement its vision. No waiting around.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it underscores that strategic choice we just mentioned.
Huh?
Acting decisively from the top, especially when other branches are less active or, well, completely dormant as Congress was.
Exactly.
This approach allows for rapid policy implementation, sure, but it also generates immediate friction and legal challenges, which we'll definitely delve into. It's a bold strategy, isn't it? Trading potential long-term consensus for immediate top-down impact.
It is. Let's get into the details. Okay, let's dive into what can really only be described as a coordinated set of four executive orders, all signed on August 25th.
Four of them, yeah.
Signaling a strategic focus on centralizing control over criminal justice policy. And the District of Columbia, D.C., it really appears to be both a testing ground and a justification for a broader national agenda, almost like a playbook for federal intervention.
And the crucial point here becomes, you know, what are the constitutional boundaries? Mm-hmm. When the federal executive attempts to override local policy choices like this, especially regarding criminal justice, where is the line?
Right.
The tension between federal and state or federal and local authority, that's a core theme here. And these orders, they push those boundaries significantly. Huge implications for federalism.
Okay, the first of these, an executive order titled Taking Steps to End Cashless Bail to Protect Americans. This establishes a national policy, basically saying federal resources should not support state or local jurisdictions that use cashless bail.
It's a broad declaration, directly linking federal funding to that specific criminal justice reform issue.
And the implementation steps.
Well, they're quite detailed. It directs the Attorney General to submit a list of all cashless bail jurisdictions within 30 days. Just 30 days.
Wow.
And after that, all executive departments and agencies working with the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, they must identify federal funds provided to these places that could be legally suspended or terminated.
So it's not a suggestion.
Oh, no. It's a direct threat of financial consequence. Mm. And the administration's premise for this is laid out pretty clearly. They state cashless bail allows dangerous individuals to immediately return to the streets and forces law enforcement to arrest the same individuals, sometimes for the same crimes. That's their justification.
So the core insight here, it isn't just about bail policy itself, is it? It's about the administration pioneering maybe a new, more aggressive level of financial strong-arming, using funding to dictate local policy nationwide.
Fundamentally reshaping those federal state power dynamics.
But this wasn't just a broad national threat, was it? The administration immediately applied it directly to Washington, D.C., with two more orders right after this one.
Exactly. They didn't waste any time. The next executive order, measures to end cashless bail and enforce the law in the District of Columbia, applies this anti-cashless bail policy specifically and immediately to the nation's capital.
How?
Citing an earlier crime emergency declaration from August 11th, it directs federal law enforcement agencies, think FBI, marshals, maybe others, to ensure D.C. arrestees are held in federal custody and subject to federal charges to the fullest extent permissible under applicable law.
So, bypassing DC's own system.
Explicitly, it's a strategy to bypass the district's local judicial process, which, it's worth remembering, has largely eliminated cash bail since way back in the 1990s.
Right.
And the attorney general is also directed to basically compel the city to change its practices through, you guessed it, funding decisions, withholding money.
But this sounds like a direct challenge to DC's home rule that's the law granting the district some degree of self-governance, isn't it? What kind of legal standing does DC have to fight this?
Indeed, it is an aggressive assertion of federal authority over DC's right to self-governance. I mean, using federal law enforcement to bypass local courts, this order effectively nullifies a key aspect of the district's own criminal justice system.
So what's the reaction?
Well, local officials and civil liberties groups, they've condemned this, calling it a blatant power grab that undermines democracy for DC residents. And the district, well, they have already initiated legal challenges,
On what grounds?
arguing that an executive order can't just unilaterally override locally enacted laws and judicial processes established under the Home Rule Act. The courts are going to have to weigh federal supremacy versus the limited self-governance DC was granted. It's a major legal fight brewing.
And building on that crime emergency narrative, there was a third executive order focused on DC, right?
Yes. Additional measures to address the crime emergency in the District of Columbia. This one mandates hiring additional U.S. Park Police and more federal prosecutors specifically for D.C., further expanding the federal footprint in the city's law enforcement.
Okay, more federal personnel. But wasn't there something else, something involving the military?
Ah, yes. That's the truly provocative part. Most significantly, it directs the Secretary of Defense to immediately create and begin training, manning, hiring, and equipping a specialized unit within the District of Columbia National Guard
Specialized for what?
that is dedicated to ensuring public safety and order and assisting law enforcement in quelling civil disturbances.
Quelling civil disturbances, that language is pointed.
It is, and it goes even further. It directs the Secretary to ensure National Guard units in every state are resourced, trained, and available for rapid nationwide deployment for similar purposes.
Okay, hold on. What you've just described for DC, that specialized National Guard unit specifically for civil disturbances, and then preparing for nationwide deployment for the same thing, that sounds like a profound shift. How does that compare to our historical understanding of the Guard's domestic role, especially regarding the Posse Comitatus Act?
Well, you're right to raise posse comitatus, the creation of a specialized military unit for domestic public order, and especially the preparation for nationwide guard deployments for these purposes. It certainly blurs the traditional line between military and civilian roles, very blurry. And it raises serious concerns regarding the spirit, if not the absolute letter, of the Posse Comitatus Act. That law, as you know, generally prohibits using the military for domestic law enforcement. It's meant to ensure our armed forces aren't used against their own citizens.
Are there exceptions?
Yes, there are exceptions.
Yeah.
During extreme emergencies, insurrections, things like that, when specifically authorized by law. But establishing a standing unit specifically for quelling civil disturbances on potentially a regular basis, that pushes the boundaries of that separation.
What are critics saying?
Critics view this as potentially a foundational step toward the use of military force to manage domestic political dissent. Some have described it as approaching authoritarianism. At the very least, it certainly risks politicizing the military and compromising its traditional neutrality in domestic affairs. It's a very significant development.
Wow. Okay. And then finally, the fourth order in this law and order group, prosecuting burning of the American flag. This one directs the Attorney General to prosecute individuals who burn the American flag.
Right. And during the signing ceremony, the president even stated that those convicted should face a mandatory 1-year jail sentence.
But isn't flag burning protected speech?
Exactly. This directive is a direct challenge to longstanding Supreme Court precedent. Back in 1989, the case Texas v. Johnson, the court ruled quite clearly that flag burning is a form of symbolic speech protected by the First Amendment.
So this order is
unconstitutional, based on current precedent. Any prosecution under this executive order would almost certainly be struck down by the courts.
Then why issue it?
Well, the order's primary impact seems to be political and cultural, not legal. It serves as a powerful signal to the administration's base, and it forces a constitutional confrontation over a deeply polarizing issue. It's more about the message than the immediate legal enforceability.
That specific order, given the clear Supreme Court precedent, it really does seem almost designed to provoke a legal challenge, doesn't it? What does that tell us about the administration's strategy, knowing it will likely be overturned?
Well, the strategic brilliance, or perhaps the risk, depending on your view, lies in its willingness to directly confront established legal precedent, even on matters where the outcome, legally, is almost certainly a defeat in court.
Right.
This isn't really about achieving a legal victory. It's much more about signaling a particular ideological stance and mobilizing a political base. It's using executive power for symbolic purposes rather than immediately actionable legal ones. They know will likely be overturned, but politically they might still achieve their objective of rallying support and framing a cultural battle. It's a form of political theater almost.
Using the executive order pen as a tool for political messaging, even against established law. #synthesis of law and order directives. So putting these four law and order directives together, all issued on a single day, it really points to a deliberate and highly coordinated strategy. It feels like a very clear playbook being rolled out.
Indeed it does. The administration's actions in the District of Columbia, they appear designed to serve as both a justification and a template for broader national policy.
Oh, so?
Well, think about the sequence. First, declare a crime emergency in D.C. Now, it's worth noting that claim is factually contested. Data actually showed violent crime in the city had recently fallen to a 30-year low.
Right, I remember reading that.
But the administration declares the emergency anyway. That creates a narrative of crisis.
Okay.
This narrative is then used to justify this unprecedented federal intervention that overrides local governance in D.C. And then this intervention in D.C. is presented as a model for how other jurisdictions should act. And the National Cashless Bail Order provides the coercive mechanism, the stick, right, the threat of defunding to enforce compliance nationwide.
It transforms the whole federal grant system.
Exactly. From what was often a tool of cooperative federalism, partnerships between levels of government, into an instrument of political leverage, almost punitive leverage.
So it's a carefully orchestrated sequence. Declare a crisis, perhaps even if the data doesn't fully support it. Intervene heavily in a jurisdiction like D.C., which has limited power to resist, and then use that intervention as both justification and leverage for national policy change. It's a powerful and maybe, for some, a concerning playbook that could potentially be replicated elsewhere.
It does raise serious questions. One has to wonder what happens to democratic processes and local autonomy in such a system. When the executive branch defines the crisis, chooses the intervention, and dictates compliance through funding threats, it creates a very powerful, very centralized model of governance. The long-term implications for the balance of power between federal and local authorities are, well, profound.
Okay, so that's the executive's domestic playbook, laid bare over just a few days. But the administration also made significant waves on the international stage this week, demonstrating a similarly bold, maybe even disruptive approach to foreign policy.
That's right.
Let's pivot now to what seems like a monumental shift in how the U.S. engages with Syria. The administration finalized a significant realignment of its Middle East policy with the formal removal of the comprehensive sanctions regime against Syria. This is a huge change after over a decade of really strict measures, isn't it?
It is a monumental change.
Right.
And it signals a broader strategic shift in how the U.S. is approaching economic statecraft. It seems aimed at reshaping geopolitical alliances and countering regional adversaries, particularly Iran, it looks like.
Right.
It's a very calculated move with deep implications, moving away from that blunt instrument of total isolation towards something more surgical and perhaps transactional.
Let's break down the action itself. On August 25th, 2025, the Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, we call it OFAC, published a final rule in the Federal Register. And this rule removes the Syrian sanctions regulations, that's 31 CFR Part 542, from the Code of Federal Regulations.
Right, that was the final administrative step, making it official.
And this rule became effective when?
August 26, 2025. So effective today as we record this.
And this action, it formally dismantles the comprehensive economic sanctions program that had isolated Syria for, what, over a decade?
Over a decade, yes. This implements policy that was actually set forth a bit earlier in Executive Order 11312, which was signed back on June 30th. That EO terminated the national emergency concerning Syria, an emergency first declared way back in 2004, and it revoked six underlying executive orders that built up that sanctions regime over the years.
What's the administration's stated reason for this reversal?
The official rationale is the transformation of circumstances in Syria following the fall of the Bashar al-Assad regime, and also positive actions taken by the new Syrian government under President Ahmed al-Shara. That's the official line.
Okay, so what's the immediate impact? What does this actually do?
The immediate impact is huge. First, it unblocks property and interest, think frozen assets, of 518 individuals and entities. These were sanctioned solely under the old Syria program.
So they're back in business, essentially.
For interactions with the U.S., yes. It allows U.S. persons and financial institutions to resume transactions with them. This effectively reopens the Syrian economy to U.S. trade and investment, at least in theory. It even permits American banks to establish correspondent relationships, basic banking ties with Syrian financial institutions, including the Central Bank of Syria.
Wow. So for you, the listener, this means a completely different economic landscape if you were looking at engaging with Syria, a major opening. But what about the bad actors, the individuals and entities we might still want to keep an eye on or keep pressure on? The policy isn't a complete blanket removal of all pressure, is it?
No, not at all. And that's a crucial nuance here. Concurrent with that June 30th executive order that started this process, 139 specific individuals and entities were redesignated.
Who are they?
Well, the list includes Bashar al-Assad himself, his key loyalists, known human rights abusers, people involved in the Captagon drug trade, and crucially, those linked to Iran, its proxies like Hezbollah or terrorism networks. They were redesignated under a separate, more targeted authority executive order, 13894.
So it's complicated.
It creates a very complex compliance environment. Broad engagement with the Syrian state itself is now permissible, theoretically. But companies and banks need extreme vigilance to avoid any dealings with these remaining 139 sanctioned parties. It requires careful screening. #2. Strategic recalibration and implications.
Geopolitically, this move signals a U.S. endorsement, maybe a tentative one, of Syria's new leadership. And it seems intended to facilitate the country's reconstruction, right? But I imagine it also raises some difficult questions, especially internationally.
It certainly does. Big questions. It raises difficult questions about accountability for the massive war crimes committed under the previous Assad regime. How is justice served? And it may create friction with some international allies who advocate for a much more cautious approach to re-engaging with Syria. They might see this as moving too fast.
So this policy shift, it's more than just reacting to Assad's fall.
Oh, yes. It represents a significant strategic recalibration of U.S. power and influence in the Middle East. The administration isn't abandoning sanctions altogether. It's shifting from using sanctions as that blunt countrywide embargo to using them as a more surgical instrument.
A scalpel instead of a sledgehammer.
Precisely. By dismantling the broad sanctions that affected the entire Syrian economy and population, while simultaneously redesignating those specific individuals and networks tied to the old regime and, importantly, its Iranian patrons, the U.S. is executing a very sophisticated carrot and stick strategy.
Offering the carrot of economic reopening to the new government.
While keeping the stick ready for those still aligned with Iran or involved in illicit activities.
So the primary strategic objective here, it seems pretty clear, is trying to sever the deep ties between Damascus and Tehran. Economic relief is essentially being made contingent on the new Syrian government distancing itself from Iran and its proxies.
That appears to be the core calculation.
This is really a masterful display of economic statecraft, isn't it? Turning sanctions into a strategic bargaining chip rather than just a blunt weapon of punishment. It's a big gamble, clearly, but potentially a big win for U.S. interests if it actually works to reorient Syria away from Iran and achieve those broader strategic goals in the region.
The strategic innovation, the sophistication of the approach, is what's really fascinating here. It's not about being simply soft or hard on Syria anymore. It's about being strategic, flexible, and frankly, quite nuanced.
Yeah.
This challenges a lot of the traditional thinking around sanctions policy, and it could indeed set a precedent for how the U.S. navigates complex geopolitical transitions in other regions in the future. It aims to create a powerful incentive for the new government to pivot westward by offering tangible economic opportunity while still maintaining pressure on those elements deemed hostile to U.S. interests. This action might very well serve as a blueprint for future U.S. policy in post-conflict or regime change scenarios elsewhere.
Okay, let's turn now to something quite different. An initiative focused more internally on how the government itself looks and feels to its citizens. On August 26th, Executive Order 14338, titled Improving Our Nation Through Better Design, was published. This launched something called the America by Design Initiative. Sounds almost like a federal government makeover.
Well, it's certainly presented that way, but it's about more than just aesthetics, I think. It seems to be an effort to impose a more corporate brand-conscious ethos onto the federal bureaucracy. It reflects a push for efficiency and modernization, yes, but potentially with deeper political undertones about how the government presents itself, its image, to the public.
Let's look at the order itself. What's the stated rationale for this? Why now?
The order states that while America leads the world in innovation, the federal government's digital services, things like websites and apps, have lagged behind in usability and aesthetics. It says they create digital potholes that waste citizens' time and taxpayer money.
Okay, fair enough. So what does it do about it?
It establishes two new entities right within the White House. First, a National Design Studio, or NDS. Second, the position of a chief design officer for the nation.
A chief design officer, like in a tech company.
Exactly that vibe. The stated goal is to deliver digital and physical experiences that are both beautiful and efficient.
And how will they achieve that?
Agency heads are directed to consult with this new chief design officer to improve their high-impact websites and physical sites. Think maybe social security offices or national park visitor centers.
Mm.
And they want initial results by July 4th, 2026, a symbolic date.
The 250th anniversary. And who is the chief design officer?
Joe Gibbia, who is a co-founder of Airbnb and also has ties to Tesla, was very quickly appointed as the first chief design officer. That appointment itself signals an intent to bring a specific Silicon Valley kind of ethos to federal operations.
Does this have potential benefits?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
This order definitely has the potential to produce tangible improvements in how citizens interact with their government. We've all dealt with clunky government websites, right? Centralizing design standards could help overcome bureaucratic inertia.
Mm-hmm.
And the directive to update the U.S. web design system and ensure compliance with the 21st Century Integrated Digital Experience Act, or IDEA Act, that provides a solid framework for creating more consistent, accessible, and mobile-friendly government platforms. That's all good stuff.
But
initiative also represents a significant centralization of administrative control. It gives the White House direct influence over the public-facing presentation, the brand, if you will, of every single federal agency.
So imagine government services feeling as intuitive as your favorite app, or maybe visit to a well-designed store like an Apple store. That sounds great on the surface for you, the user, but yeah. You're saying there's more to it than just pretty websites, isn't there?
Absolutely. The crucial point here becomes, when does a focus on beauty and design cross the line into political branding? While it's framed in this neutral language of technocratic improvement, the America by Design initiative also seems to function as a quite sophisticated political branding exercise.
How so?
Well, the executive order's emphasis extends beyond just usability. It explicitly includes beauty and aesthetics. And a newly launched promotional website explicitly links the administration's own brand with the United States of America brand. Design is a really powerful form of communication. By seizing control over the look and feel of the government's digital and physical front door, the White House gains an unparalleled opportunity to project its own values, values like order, strength, maybe corporate efficiency.
Politicization of the pixel, I heard someone call it that. That seems like a pretty good way to put it. It sounds like they're trying to create a unified brand experience for the government, but that brand is very much aligned with the administration's specific ideology and image.
Exactly. This politicization of the pixel, as you say, it could lead to a future where the design of government services changes dramatically with each new administration, which could actually undermine the goal of a consistent and trusted citizen experience in the long run. It's an attempt to shape public perception through design. It's not just about improving services. It's very much about projecting a specific image of efficiency, strength, and a certain kind of American identity, as defined by this White House. And that could have real implications for public trust and the continuity of government services if the brand keeps shifting radically every 4 or 8 years.
Yeah.
Hashtag tag tag D, commemorative actions and public statements.
Okay, finally, on the executive side, there was a solemn action, but one that became, well, politically charged. On August 25th, the president signed a proclamation to honor the 13 U.S. service members killed during the Abbey Gate bombing in Kabul, Afghanistan, back on August 26th, 2021.
Right. Commemorations like this are usually moments intended for national unity, bringing the country together in shared remembrance and grief. But this particular one, well, it became a platform for pretty sharp partisan criticism, leveraging a very tragic event for political messaging.
Let's look at the action itself. The president signed the proclamation in the Oval Office. Reports say approximately 35 family members of the fallen service members were in attendance. It was a formal, public acknowledgement of their sacrifice.
Yes, formally commemorative. But its execution was overtly political. The president used this solemn occasion, with the families right there, to launch a very sharp attack on the previous administration, the one that oversaw the withdrawal from Afghanistan. He described the day of the attack as one of the dumbest days in the history of our country.
Strong words on such an occasion.
Very strong. And this sentiment was echoed by the vice president, who characterized the proclamation not just as honoring the fallen, but as a rectification of a wrong committed by the prior administration, attributing it to their incompetence.
So the framing was explicitly critical of the past administration.
Exactly. This framing converted an event that is typically about national mourning and unity into a platform for direct partisan criticism. It leveraged the presence and, frankly, the grief of Gold Star families for political messaging against opponents.
That's a stark contrast to how these types of anniversaries are often handled, isn't it? Usually the focus is solely on remembrance and unity. For you, the listener, it really highlights how even deeply somber occasions can now be folded into the ongoing political narrative, potentially deepening political polarization around matters of military service and national sacrifice.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture of the executive actions we've discussed, it reflects a broader strategy, doesn't it? Using every available platform, regardless of traditional norms or sensitivities, to reinforce the administration's narrative and criticize opponents. This really challenges the line between governance and perpetual campaigning and raises questions about how far an administration will go to achieve its political objectives, even using moments of national tragedy.
Okay, so while the White House was buzzing with these high-profile executive orders and proclamations, the vast machinery of the federal administrative state, the agencies, the bureaucracy, it continued its routine but absolutely essential functions. The daily publications of the Federal Register give us a window into this ongoing, often less visible, but incredibly important work.
That's right. This reveals a government operating on, well, almost a parallel track. You have the high-level political directives, and then you have the technical regulation and statutory implementation happening day in, day out within the agencies, often quite independent of the immediate political agenda driving those presidential directives. It's the essential ongoing work that keeps the country running, regardless of who's in the Oval Office.
Let's get a sense of the scale. Hashtag tag, 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 AA overview of Federal Register activity. On just one day, August 25th, 2025, the Federal Register's public inspection desk processed 95 documents, 95, from at least 42 different agencies.
Oh.
This included a mix of notices, proposed rules, final rules, all scheduled for publication. That's a huge volume for a single day.
And remember, this daily output is just a small fraction of the total activity for the year. As of August 25th, just the Executive Office of the President alone had published 378 documents in the Register for the year. Agencies like NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, had published 621 documents. NIH, the National Institutes of Health, 684 documents.
So thousands upon thousands of actions.
Exactly. This data just underscores the immense scope of the administrative state's non-discretionary and specialized work. Much of this proceeds largely independently of the political agenda driving the presidential directives we just talked about. It's the bedrock of governance, happening constantly.
It's easy to get caught up in the big, splashy executive orders, isn't it? But this sheer volume of daily activity from countless agencies, it reminds us how much quieter but absolutely critical work happens constantly, just ensuring the continuity of government functions day to day.
Precisely. This is the stuff that, you know, ensures airplanes are safe to fly, that fishing quotas are set sustainably, that critical minerals for our economy are identified, that new drugs are reviewed. It's the constant, often unglamorous, but vital work that keeps the country functioning and provides the necessary regulations and guidelines for countless industries and aspects of our daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
Hashtag TechShakeBe, key regulatory actions.
Okay, let's look at just a few specific examples of agency actions during this exact period, August 23rd to 26th, just to give you, the listener, a flavor of the sheer diversity and granularity of federal governance happening beyond the White House headlines.
Okay, well, first, the Department of the Treasury's OFAC, as we already discussed in detail, published that final rule on August 25th, removing the serious sanctions regulations. That's a prime example of implementing a major foreign policy decision right down at the agency level.
Right, what else?
Second, the Department of the Interior. On August 26th, the department published a notice reopening the public comment period for a broad regulatory reform request for information. Now, this is part of a longer-term administration effort to identify and potentially eliminate regulations that it perceives as burdensome.
Which could impact?
Well, it could have significant potential impacts down the line on environmental protection rules, land management policies, things like that. For you listening, this means there's another chance to weigh in on existing regulations that could affect your daily life, your business, or the environment.
Okay, what else stands out?
The U.S. Geological Survey, USGS. They filed a notice on August 25th for the 2025 draft list of critical minerals. The finalization of this list is actually a crucial step in U.S. economic and national security strategy.
Why is that list so important?
Because it guides policy on things like domestic mining, processing, and building resilient supply chains for materials essential to defense, clean energy, high-tech industries, think lithium, cobalt, rare earths. Identifying what's critical is the first step.
Got it. Anything else?
Well, just to show the range, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, filed a rule to manage the reallocation of Pacific cod in the Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands management area. Sounds super technical, right?
Right here.
But this has direct economic consequences for the multi-billion dollar U.S. fishing industry. It impacts livelihoods, regional economies in places like Alaska. These technical rules matter immensely to specific sectors.
And maybe one more for safety?
Sure. The Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, they filed a new airworthiness directive concerning certain ATRGE avions to transport regional airplanes. This represents that critical, nonpartisan safety of life mission that is such a core function of the regulatory state, making sure planes are safe to fly.
So from global geopolitics with Syria, to cod quotas in Alaska, to critical minerals for future tech, to basic airplane safety, these examples really show the incredible breadth of issues the administrative state deals with literally every single day.
Absolutely. And the innovation, or maybe just the routine function we see here, is how this work proceeds, often completely outside the immediate political spotlight. Yet it has profound real-world consequences for industries, public health, safety, the economy. This is the government at its most technical and often arguably its most effective, operating under specific statutory mandates and established procedures. It demonstrates that essential, continuous function that has to happen regardless of political winds. #HashtagC. Tension between political and administrative agendas.
But these daily operations documented in the Federal Register, when you put them alongside the big executive orders, they seem to reveal a fundamental tension within the executive branch itself. It's almost like two different governments operating simultaneously, isn't it?
Precisely. That's a great way to put it. On one hand, you have the White House driving this highly ideological, often confrontational agenda through executive orders aimed at radically reshaping policy in specific areas.
Right, the top-down push.
Exactly. Yeah. And on the other hand, you have the career bureaucracy, the civil servants across dozens of agencies, engaged in the technical, often statute-bound, day-to-day work of governance. And sometimes these two things are in conflict.
How so?
Well, the administration's broader stated goals of, say, reducing the size and scope of the federal bureaucracy, or rein in what it sometimes views as an unaccountable deep state, those goals are often in direct conflict with the necessary functioning of this very administrative apparatus that carries out the laws Congress passes.
So the executive orders we talked about, they represent the political leadership's attempt to impose its will from the top down.
Yes. And then initiatives like that Interior Department, regulatory reform requests for information, or previous reviews of federal funding for certain non-governmental organizations, those are mechanisms by which this political agenda seeks to gain control over or reshape the ongoing administrative work.
But can they succeed easily?
Well, the ultimate success of the administration's really transformative ambitions, it's going to depend heavily on its ability to translate its broad, sometimes sweeping executive orders into the detailed, legally durable regulations that are the actual currency of the administrative state.
That's not easy.
No, it's a slow, incredibly complex process. It's fraught with legal and procedural challenges, public comment periods, court reviews. That friction between the top-down political will and the bottom-up bureaucratic reality is a constant challenge for any administration trying to make big changes quickly.
So while the president issues these grand directives, the actual implementation has to grind through this immense, often slow-moving bureaucracy. It really is a bit like trying to steer a supertanker with a speedboat, isn't it? The sheer inertia, the legal requirements, the expertise within the administrative state can make rapid, fundamental change incredibly difficult to achieve in practice.
Which raises an important question, doesn't it? One has to wonder, can a highly centralized, top-down political agenda truly succeed in fundamentally altering the vast, complex administrative state? Or will it inevitably get bogged down in those legal and procedural realities, ultimately diluting the intended impact or maybe even creating unintended consequences? That friction between these two forces, that the political appointees and the career civil service, the executive orders and the detailed regulations, that will likely be a defining characteristic of this administration's governance.
Okay, now let's turn to Congress and prepare for a stark contrast, a really stark contrast. In striking opposition to the hyperactivity we just described in the executive branch, the U.S. Congress was effectively dormant during this period, just quiet.
Completely quiet. A legislative vacuum, really, which, as you'll see, only amplified the impact of the executive's unilateral actions. It allowed them to proceed without any immediate legislative challenge or oversight whatsoever.
Let's look at what didn't happen. #AA, pro forma sessions and inactivity. So, from August 23rd straight through to August 26, 2025, both the House of Representatives and the Senate were technically in session, but only in what are called pro forma sessions.
Right. And for you, the listener, pro forma basically means as a matter of form. It's a procedural state. The chambers convened, gaveled in, for only a few minutes usually, and conducted absolutely no substantive business, no debates, no votes.
How brief were they?
Well, on August 25th, for example, the House met at 9 a.m. and adjourned at 9:22 a.m.
2 minutes?
2 minutes. Similarly, the Senate convened for a pro forma session on August 25th and again on August 26th. Zero floor activity. No debates, no votes taking place.
Yeah.
And crucially, no committee hearings were scheduled or held in either chamber during this entire period.
So no platform for any response?
None. No oversight hearings, no legislative action, nothing.
Just 2 minutes for the House in one day. This legislative inactivity, I mean, it's common during August recesses. We should acknowledge that.
It is traditional.
But given the flurry of executive action happening simultaneously, it created a significant power vacuum in Washington during these key days, didn't it?
Absolutely. And the crucial point here becomes, what happens to the constitutional balance of power when one branch, the legislative, is effectively dormant, while another branch, the executive, is aggressively asserting its authority? It fundamentally shifts the dynamic, at least temporarily, and allows those unilateral actions to gain immediate traction without the usual legislative scrutiny or pushback. #B, impact of legislative vacuum.
So with Congress essentially absent, the executive branch faced absolutely no immediate legislative or oversight checks on its authority. This created an unprecedented opportunity, really, for unilateral action.
Yes, completely unchecked in real time. That flurry of controversial executive orders we discussed on crime, on federalism, the D.C. interventions, even flag burning, they were all issued without any possibility of a concurrent congressional hearing or a resolution of disapproval being introduced or even just informal pushback from committee chairs who might normally raise concerns.
The normal channels were closed.
Completely closed. This dynamic dramatically tilted the constitutional balance of power toward the executive during these days. It allowed the president to single-handedly dominate and define the national policy agenda.
It's such a clear demonstration, isn't it, of what happens when one branch steps back, even for a recess, and another branch steps forward aggressively to fill that void. The executive essentially had a free hand during these critical days to push through a significant part of its agenda without immediate contestation.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it really highlights just how crucial active congressional oversight is for maintaining that balance. Without it, the executive's actions, no matter how controversial or legally questionable they might seem, can proceed unimpeded in the short term. This allows them to set precedents and implement policies that then become much harder to reverse later, even when Congress eventually reconvenes and decides to act. The initial momentum matters.
Okay, so the executive was hyperactive, the legislature was quiet. What about the third branch? The judicial branch continued its essential work, didn't it? The federal appellate courts, for instance, they continued hearing cases, issuing rulings, shaping the legal landscape upon which these future policy battles stemming from those executive orders will inevitably be fought.
Exactly. The judiciary often serves as the ultimate arbiter, doesn't it? Particularly when executive actions push against constitutional boundaries, as several of these seem to do. And even while the Supreme Court itself is in recess, its shadow looms large over everything. Meanwhile, the lower federal courts are actively working, clarifying legal principles, resolving disputes which ultimately impact the daily lives of citizens and the operations of government at all levels. Their work didn't stop.
Let's start at the top. A U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court itself, it was in its summer recess during this period, August 23rd to 26th. So it issued no orders or opinions, no immediate judicial response to the executive's actions came from the highest court.
That's right. They were quiet during these specific days. However, it's important to note that the court's docket for the upcoming 2025-26 term, which starts in October, it already includes cases with potentially significant implications for some of the administration's broader policies. Things like challenges to campaign finance limits, questions about judicial deference to immigration authorities, the scope of copyright law in the digital age. Big issues are already queued up.
And what about the actions from this week?
Well, importantly, those executive orders issued during this period, particularly that directive to prosecute flag burning, are direct challenges to establish Supreme Court precedent, as we discussed. They are almost certain to generate litigation that will wind its way up through the court system and ultimately likely be decided by the Supreme Court itself.
So while they weren't active these few days, the Supreme Court is definitely going to have its hands full dealing with the legal fallout from some of these executive actions down the line, especially that flag-burning order. It seems like almost a direct invitation for a constitutional challenge to land right on their doorstep.
It does seem designed that way. And the crucial point here becomes, how will the current Supreme Court respond to such direct challenges to its own longstanding precedents? It will be a crucial test, not only of the specific legal issues, but also of judicial independence and the principle of stare decisis, that idea that courts should generally stand by previous decisions, especially in an era where executive power is being asserted so aggressively against established legal norms. It's a major test for the institution.
Okay, so while the Supreme Court was in recess, the lower courts were still working. On August 25th, for instance, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, that's the nation's largest federal appellate court, covering the western states, they issued several published opinions. And published opinions have the potential to create binding precedent, at least within that circuit.
Right.
These cases give us a glimpse into the everyday, yet often profound work of justice that continues across the country, regardless of the political storms in Washington.
Absolutely. These rulings really demonstrate how the judiciary continues its work, clarifying legal principles, sometimes upholding constitutional rights, even when the other branches are focused on these larger policy battles. And they have real-world implications for individuals and for how government agencies have to operate. Let's look at a couple.
Okay, let's start with a case called Garza et al. V. Woods et al. This one originated from the District of Arizona. What happened here?
In this case, the Ninth Circuit panel reversed a lower court's decision to dismiss the case. They essentially revived a constitutional challenge to Arizona's Unclaimed Property Act.
What were the plaintiffs arguing?
The plaintiffs alleged that the state of Arizona took custody of their unclaimed funds, money held by third-party businesses that supposedly belonged to them, but did so without providing adequate notice beforehand. They argued this violated their right to procedural due process under the 14th Amendment. Basically, the state took their property without properly telling them first.
And the Ninth Circuit agreed.
They agreed it was a plausible claim that needed to go forward. The court held that the plaintiffs had plausibly alleged they had a protected property interest in those funds, and they had stated a viable claim that they were deprived of this interest without constitutionally sufficient notice. The key was the timing and adequacy of the notice.
What's the impact of this ruling? Why does it matter?
Well, it reinforces a really important constitutional requirement. The government generally has to provide meaningful notice before it takes control of an individual's property. Even if that property is technically considered unclaimed, due process still applies.
Right.
It serves as a check on state administrative power. And it could influence how other states within the Ninth Circuit, California, Oregon, Washington, etc., manage their own unclaimed property programs. They might need to review their notice procedures.
So this is a critical protection for you, the individual listening. It ensures that even if the state thinks your property is unclaimed, they still have to follow due process rules, particularly around notice. It's a good example, isn't it, of the judiciary acting as a safeguard for individual rights against potential administrative overreach by the state.
Exactly. And what's fascinating here is how these seemingly technical rulings on things like procedural due process, they actually have broad implications for all sorts of government-citizen interactions across a whole range of administrative actions. It encourages critical thinking about things like the presumption of notice and ensures that fundamental constitutional rights are respected, even in what might seem like routine state operations. Details matter in the law.
Okay, next up, a criminal case. USA v. Sylvia Olivas. This one was complex. It had actually been up to the Supreme Court and sent back down, originating in the Central District of California. It involves Sylvia Olivas' conviction for acting as a secretary within a violent street gang.
Right. The core issue on appeal was whether the trial court, the district court, committed what's called plain error, a really obvious mistake, by allowing an expert witness, probably a law enforcement officer specializing in gangs, to testify about the roles within the gang.
What did the expert say?
The expert testified generally that gang secretaries typically know everything about the gang's criminal activities. And then later in the testimony, the expert specifically identified Olivas as having acted as a secretary for this gang.
What was the defense's objection?
The defense argued this violated Federal Rule of Evidence 704B. That rule prohibits an expert witness from stating an opinion about whether the specific defendant had the particular mental state like knowledge or intent that constitutes an element of the crime charged. Here, the crime was conspiracy, which requires knowing participation. The defense said the expert basically told the jury Olivas knew everything, which is the ultimate question for the jury.
And how did the Ninth Circuit rule on this?
The Ninth Circuit panel found there was no plain error. They upheld the conviction.
What was their reasoning? Why wasn't it a violation?
The court reasoned that the expert's statements weren't actually a direct conclusion about Olivas' specific mental state. Instead, they viewed it as testimony about the general roles, knowledge structures, and operational methods within that type of criminal organization, helping the jury understand how such gangs function.
So it was general background, not specific mind reading.
That was the court's interpretation, yes. That the testimony helped the jury understand the context, but didn't cross the line into stating Olivas' personal knowledge or intent directly.
What's the impact of this ruling?
Well, this ruling provides important clarification, or perhaps affirms existing practice on the boundaries of expert testimony in complex conspiracy cases. By adopting what seems like a relatively narrow interpretation of Rule 704B, the court gives prosecutors perhaps greater latitude to use expert witnesses to explain the inner workings of sophisticated criminal enterprises, like gangs or drug cartels, to a jury. And that could potentially aid in securing convictions in these difficult cases.
So for you, listening, this case illustrates the really fine line courts have to walk with expert testimony in these complex criminal trials. It allows juries to get context and understand how these intricate criminal organizations might operate, but it also raises continuing questions about potentially influencing the jury's perception of the specific defendant's guilt or knowledge. It requires very careful handling by judges and lawyers.
Absolutely. It raises that important question about how we balance the genuine need for expert insight in complex cases. Jurors often need help understanding these worlds with the fundamental protection of a defendant's right not to have an expert directly testify about their mental state. That ultimate question of guilt or innocence, knowledge or intent, that's supposed to be for the jury alone to decide. It's a very delicate balance indeed.
Okay, one more quick example from the courts. Maybe something on immigration, which is often a big area for federal courts.
Sure. There was also a case called Lopez v. Bondi, which came to the Ninth Circuit from the Board of Immigration Appeals, or BIA.
What's the BIA?
The BIA is the highest administrative body within the Department of Justice for interpreting and applying immigration laws. They hear appeals from immigration judges' decisions.
And what did the Ninth Circuit do in this Lopez case?
Well, this specific decision, which was what's called a memorandum disposition, meaning not fully precedential, it actually affirmed the BIA's dismissal of Mr. Lopez's appeal. It was dismissed on procedural grounds because he apparently failed to clearly specify the reasons for his appeal.
Okay, so that specific case outcome might not seem huge.
Right. The outcome for Mr. Lopez wasn't groundbreaking. But the case is significant because it represents the ongoing judicial review that federal courts, like the Ninth Circuit, conduct over decisions made by the BIA.
So the courts are keeping an eye on the DIA.
Constantly. This case is just one small part of a much broader body of Ninth Circuit case law where the court scrutinizes BIA actions. Other recent decisions have tackled really substantive issues, like defining what constitutes a crime involving moral turpitude, a term that has huge deportation consequences, or setting standards for reviewing claims that an immigrant received ineffective assistance from their previous lawyer.
Why is this judicial review so important in immigration?
The judiciary's role in these thousands of immigration cases is absolutely crucial. It helps ensure that the BIA provides reasoned, logical explanations for its decisions and doesn't just act arbitrarily or inconsistently. It provides a check on the administrative agency's power.
And there's a bigger legal context here, too, isn't there, about how much courts should defer to agencies?
Yes, absolutely. There's ongoing litigation across the circuits, spurred by the Supreme Court's recent decision in Loper-Bright, about the whole framework of judicial deference to agency interpretations of law. How much should courts defer to an agency like the BIA when it interprets a vague immigration statute? The outcome of that broader legal debate will have lasting consequences for the balance of power between the courts and the executive branch's administrative agencies across the board, not just in immigration.
So this seemingly small procedural case reminds us that even highly technical administrative immigration decisions are subject to judicial review. And that review is a vital check on agency power, especially important for you, the individual immigrant facing potentially life-altering decisions based on these agency actions.
Exactly. And it highlights this important, evolving legal landscape concerning judicial deference. That Loper-Bright decision from the Supreme Court is really reshaping how courts review agency interpretations. It potentially gives courts more power to second-guess administrative decisions, which could have very significant effects on how laws are implemented across the federal government. It's a major legal shift underway.
Yeah.
Hashtag take vSynthesis and forward-looking analysis.
Wow. Okay, so after this really comprehensive tour of the federal government's actions just from August 23rd through August 26th, it is incredibly clear that these 4 days, while very brief, they provide a remarkably concentrated snapshot of this administration's governing philosophy and its key policy priorities right now.
It really does.
The forceful, almost relentless application of executive power was absolutely the defining characteristic, wasn't it? And it was made even more pronounced by the complete silence, the inactivity of the legislative branch during the same period.
Absolutely. It's almost a textbook case study in how power dynamics can play out in a modern administration, especially one willing to push boundaries. And it definitely sets a trajectory, lays down markers for what we can likely expect in the coming months. The rapid unilateral nature of these executive actions, particularly against that backdrop of legislative inactivity, it highlights a deliberate strategy, I think, to push through a transformative and often quite controversial agenda very quickly. Hashtag A, the concentration of executive power.
These events really do feel like a textbook case study in the modern expansion of presidential power, don't they?
I would agree. The administration demonstrated a very clear preference for using unilateral executive orders as its primary tool of governance, using them to attempt sweeping changes in domestic law enforcement, in foreign policy with Syria, and even in the structure and branding of the federal government itself with the Design Initiative.
And doing it while Congress was out.
Exactly. By issuing these major directives while Congress was effectively in recess, the executive branch became, for those days, the sole engine of federal policymaking. It marginalized the branch that is constitutionally vested with the power to actually legislate and, crucially, to conduct oversight.
What are the risks of that approach?
Well, this approach, while it certainly allows for rapid and decisive action from the president's perspective, it definitely strains the constitutional framework of separated powers. And it risks normalizing a system where the president can appear to run the country largely by decree. That's a concern legal scholars have raised for a long time about the growth of executive power. This isn't just about efficiency. It's about a fundamental shift, potentially, in how power is exercised at the federal level.
So for you, the listener, this means understanding that a lot of really big changes can happen very, very quickly when the executive branch decides to act unilaterally, especially when Congress isn't in session or is otherwise unable or unwilling to push back immediately. It compresses the timeline for policy implementation dramatically and limits the space for immediate public discourse or legislative review.
Which leads to that important question, doesn't it? One has to wonder, what are the long-term consequences for democratic governance if the legislative process is consistently bypassed or marginalized in favor of executive fiat? It fundamentally alters the checks and balances that were designed into our system and could lead over time to a less deliberative, more reactive, more top-down form of governance. #B, federalism under pressure.
And another major theme running through these actions is federalism, right? The administration's law and order agenda in particular seems to have placed the principle of federalism, the balance of power between federal and state local governments, under significant pressure.
Intense pressure. Those executive orders targeting cashless bail nationwide and asserting direct federal control over law enforcement in the District of Columbia, they aren't just policy disagreements. They represent a fundamental challenge to the autonomy of state and local governments to set their own policies in traditional areas of local control, like criminal justice.
And the tool they're using is funding.
Primarily, yes. That strategy of conditioning federal funding on compliance with federal policy preferences, it transforms federal grants from what was often intended as a means of partnership into a tool of coercion. It's a powerful leverage point, threatening funds that states and cities rely on for many things.
And the D.C. situation is even more direct.
Yes. The direct federal takeover of certain police functions in D.C., justified by the administration under the Home Rule Act, but contested by the district, that's already being legally challenged as an overreach of presidential authority. The outcomes of these legal battles, both the funding coercion cases and the D.C. direct intervention case, they will be absolutely critical in defining the future boundaries of local self-governance and the extent to which the federal executive can impose its will on states and cities, especially those with different political leanings or policy choices.
So if you're a local official, or maybe just a resident in a state or city that has policy priorities differing from the current federal administration's, you should probably be paying very close attention. Your local autonomy, the ability of your community to make its own policy choices on things like criminal justice, could be directly at stake.
Absolutely. This challenges the core traditional understanding of our federal system, where states and local governments are meant to have significant authority over their own affairs, particularly in areas like policing and local courts. The courts, as we said, will be crucial in drawing the lines here, but the very act of pushing these boundaries so aggressively creates significant legal and political instability right now. It's forcing a reevaluation of that balance of power between Washington and the rest of the country. #HairTagShakeC. Emerging policy trajectories and outlook.
Okay, so based on the actions we've meticulously unpacked over these 4 days, it seems like three distinct policy trajectories are becoming pretty evident. These give you, the listener, maybe a roadmap for anticipating future government action and understanding where this administration seems to be heading.
I agree. And these trajectories, they aren't just isolated events or one-offs. They seem to represent a coherent and decidedly aggressive strategy that will likely continue to define the political and legal landscape for the foreseeable future, impacting multiple sectors and levels of government. Let's break them down. #1, domestic policy.
First, on the domestic policy front, particularly around law and order and federalism, what's the likely trajectory?
Well, it seems highly likely the administration will continue and perhaps even expand its campaign to centralize control over domestic policy, especially in areas of criminal justice and law enforcement where it perceives local policies as failing or being too lenient.
Who should be concerned?
State and local governments, particularly those with progressive policies that diverge significantly from the federal agenda, should probably anticipate being targeted. They need to prepare, I think, for both fiscal pressure, that threatened withdrawal of federal funds we talked about, and potentially direct legal challenges to their authority from the federal government.
And the D.C. situation could be a model.
That's the concern. The framework established for intervening in D.C., declare an emergency, assert federal control, bypass local processes that could potentially be replicated elsewhere. The administration might declare similar emergencies in other cities it deems problematic to justify federal intervention, further expanding its reach into local affairs.
So, if your local community has implemented criminal justice reforms, like bail reform or maybe different approaches to prosecution or policing, you should be aware that these could come under direct threat from federal action and pressure in the coming months or years.
Yes. And the crucial point here becomes, to what extent will local communities be able to successfully resist this kind of federal pressure, legally and politically? And what will be the social and economic costs of that resistance or of forced compliance? It really sets up a fundamental conflict between federal directives and local democratic governance, requiring communities to think very carefully about their legal standing, their financial dependencies, and their political strategies. #2, foreign policy.
Okay, second trajectory, foreign policy. What does the Syria sanctions reversal tell us about the broader direction?
The Syria move signals, I think, a broader shift toward a more pragmatic, maybe even transactional foreign policy. Less driven by broad ideological commitments, perhaps, and more by specific strategic calculations and opportunities.
And the use of sanctions.
It suggests the U.S. is likely to continue using sanctions, but perhaps less as that blunt instrument of total isolation and more as a flexible surgical tool. Using them strategically to reward potential new partners, like the new government in Syria, perhaps, while still punishing specific adversaries or problematic networks like those linked to Iran.
What does this mean for the world?
Well, it arguably creates a more dynamic, but also maybe a more uncertain and less predictable international environment. Alliances might shift more quickly. Policies could change based on evolving deals or circumstances.
And for businesses.
For businesses and investors, they might find new opportunities opening up in formally sanctioned jurisdictions like Syria. But they must also navigate an incredibly complex and rapidly evolving compliance landscape. They need to be extremely careful that while broad sanctions are lifted, specific individuals and entities often remain blacklisted, requiring constant due diligence.
So, for those of you involved in international business, finance, or foreign relations, this trajectory means you need to be prepared for a more nuanced, potentially faster changing landscape for engagement. The rules of the game, who's in favor and who's out, could shift quickly based on these geopolitical calculations and the administration's specific strategic objectives at any given moment.
Absolutely. And the strategic innovation or shift we see here is really in the sophisticated use of economic leverage. It's a clear departure from some previous, maybe more sweeping approaches.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires constant vigilance from international actors, governments, businesses, NGOs to understand exactly who is considered permissible to deal with and who is still firmly out of favor based on the specific targeted application of these powerful economic tools. #3, administrative policy.
And finally, the third trajectory, administrative policy. What does that America by Design initiative signal about the administration's approach to the federal bureaucracy itself?
Well, that initiative seems to be part of a larger ongoing effort to remake the federal bureaucracy in the administration's image, both in its outward presentation and its internal operations and values.
You mentioned a dual approach.
Yes, it seems to involve a dual approach. On one hand, imposing this private sector, almost corporate brand-focused model of efficiency and design onto government services, making government look and feel more like a sleek tech company.
And on the other hand,
continuing efforts to challenge and perhaps dismantle what the administration views as problematic ideological constructs within the civil service itself. Things like, for example, diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI programs, which typically aim to promote fair representation and opportunities within the workforce, but which this administration may see differently.
What's the likely result of this dual approach?
It will likely exacerbate the existing friction, the tension we talked about earlier, between the political appointees driving this agenda from the top and the career civil servants who are responsible for actually implementing policies and delivering services on the ground. This could potentially impact morale, recruitment, retention, and ultimately the effective delivery of government services to the public.
So it's not just about what the government does, but fundamentally about how it does it, the process, the personnel, and the very identity it projects to its citizens and the world. This could dramatically change your experience interacting with federal services, not just making a website look nicer, but potentially altering the underlying values, priorities, and even the personnel that guide those services.
Exactly. And it raises that important final question for this trajectory. Can a corporate brand-focused ethos truly be applied effectively and beneficially to the incredibly complex, often statutory, and fundamentally public interest-driven work of the federal bureaucracy? Or will this attempt to impose a private sector model ultimately create more tension, inefficiency, and perhaps even undermine the very services it nominally seeks to improve? It's a fundamental test of governance philosophy playing out within the administrative state itself. #outro.
Wow. Sam, what an incredibly dense and truly impactful 4 days for the federal government. I mean, from attempting to reshape domestic law enforcement and federalism, to executing a major pivot in foreign policy, to starting a project to rebrand the bureaucracy itself, these actions really highlight an administration that is aggressively leveraging its power and certainly pushing the boundaries of traditional executive authority.
It truly does, Alex. And the stark contrast between the executive's rapid, almost frantic pace and Congress's complete inactivity during the same period, combined with the judiciary's ongoing work, clarifying legal principles and bracing for the inevitable challenges. It just paints such a vivid picture of our system of government under significant stress and potentially transformation. You, our listener, have gotten a genuinely deep dive into the granular detail of these pivotal events.
Indeed. And for you, our listener, perhaps here's a final provocative thought to take away from all this. Given the executive branch's aggressive use of unilateral action that we've detailed, and its apparent willingness to challenge long-established legal and political norms, what fundamental aspect of American governance do you think is most vulnerable to significant change in the coming months or years? Is it the principle of federalism and local autonomy? Is it the separation of powers between the branches? Or could it even be the traditional role of the judiciary as the ultimate arbiter of constitutional limits? Something to mull over until our next deep dive.
That is a fascinating and, frankly, crucial question to consider, isn't it? The answers will undoubtedly shape the future of our republic. That's all the time we have for this deep dive. Thank you so much for joining us. We sincerely hope you feel incredibly well informed about this pivotal period in federal government activity. We'll catch you on the next one.